this is a spoiler.
You can't listen to this and not have spoilers.
As our whole conversation to summarize this.
I was thinking about you. I was like, "What is she? I don't even know how to discuss this book, much less summarize it. It's 100 years. I mean,
well, you know, you're gonna do something. You're gonna do big, right?
Go it. Go for it.
All right. So this is frightening, but I'm gonna give it a shot. This book covers the lives of, I guess, five, six generations of the Buendia family. 100 Years of Solitude, the book we're reading. And it takes place in the fictional town called Macondo, which is located in South America somewhere. The plot can be both simple and complicated. Simple because we can just follow the generation, each generation. You know, generation one, it happens. This happens. Generation two, this happens. Generation three, this happens. But it gets very complicated because within each generation, enormous, profound things happen. Anyway, a lot of tense stuff happens within the time frame of a given generation, and it's hard to give a full summary, but hopefully we'll touch on each generation here. When we get to the simple version, it should be noted that this novel's genre is generally considered to be magical realism, and you see that throughout. And the beginning of the novel is kind of, it's set out that way because Jose Buendia, who is the founder of Macondo, he founded Macondo after he had a dream and saw houses all full of mirrored walls. And mirrors, glass, ice is a very important image that exists throughout this book and reflects the magical realism that really is going on throughout this whole story. So the town of Macondo is founded by Jose Buendia and his wife Ursula, the grand matriarch. For a long time, it's very isolated and on its own. And it's visited by these gypsies headed by Milquitas, who inspires Jose's fascination with science and the universe. And he leaves a mysterious parchment, which comes into play later in the book and is very important. Eventually, Jose, unfortunately, goes insane and he's tied up to a chestnut tree behind the house and he dies there years later. All the generations, mostly, is this matriarch Ursula, as we all know. She lives to over 100 years old. She oversees the building of the mansion for the family, the maintenance of it, and running the family, as well as a successful candy business that brings in lots of money. And one of her biggest fears, which is at the beginning of the book and runs throughout the whole book, is obviously there's a lot of incest, or a certain amount of incest. And it begins with her and Jose because they're first cousins. And it was there's this great fear that existed within her and the reality of the magical reality of what could happen when they gave birth was the fear that the child would be born with a pig's tail. That was just always a major concern. But that doesn't happen when she gives birth to her children. And it doesn't happen for a very long time until, well, we'll see. Jose and Ursula have three children. This is the second generation. This is Jose Arcadio Amaranta and Colonel Aureliano Buendia. Jose Arcadio is the oldest, and he ends up running away with a gypsy girl. Now, I'm going to be brushing past a lot of it because, as we all know, there are very intense details that happen with every character and with every generation. And so I'm just going to touch on things, and then we're going to have to dig in together because it's just so much. Okay, Jose Arcadio, he's the oldest. He ends up running away after chasing a gypsy girl, and he returns this huge man with tattoos everywhere and ends up marrying his adopted sister, and he is shot mysteriously. Amaranta never marries, and she dies spinster. And Colonel Aureliano Buendia, as we all know, is major figure through a long period of the book, as he ends up being the leader of these major wars against the conservative government. And then he ends up, he escapes being executed. And I think it's important that the beginning of the book starts with this image of him standing about to be executed and remembering the ice that his father showing him. So ice is important. Glass is important. These images. Anyway, we'll get to that. Colonel Aureliano Buendia ends up hiding in his room after these wars are over. He escapes execution and hides in his room making fish out of gold. Okay, so both Jose and Aureliano, I'm going to get lost. We're going to get lost, but let's try this. Hopefully this will work. Both Jose and Aureliano end up sleeping with the neighborhood psychic. I don't remember if she's a concubine as well, but she's a psychic sort of card reader, Pilar. They end up creating the next generation with her, Acadio, who is a school teacher, but ends up becoming a dictator figure. I believe he was, can't remember whose father of Acadio, but anyway. And then also Aureliano Jose, who becomes obsessed with his aunt Amaranta, who rebuffs him, and he's killed during the war. Moving on to the next generation, or onward. Okay, around this time, the railroad comes to Macondo, and an American fruit company, which I found out an interesting fact about, but anyway, builds there and ushers in this time of prosperity with the banana company and lots of, you know, working at work and stuff like that. Acadio marries Santa Sofia de la Piedad. She was pushed onto Acadio by Pilar, her mother. And they create this next generation, Aureliana Segundo, ends up marrying Fernanda del Carpio, who is a very upper crusty, difficult woman. Aureliano ends up taking in Pilar as his concubine, who he ends up moving in with, and even though he remains married to Fernanda, this is a whole drama in and of itself. Acadio married Santa Sofia, and they created not only Aureliana Segundo, but also Remedios, and Remedios is a very interesting character, definitely coming out of this sort of magical realism. She's this unspeakably beautiful woman who was responsible for the deaths of a number of men who were just overtaken by her beauty for many reasons. She's thought of as possibly having mental issues, autism or something, and she ends up dying by ascending into the sky. She was holding a towel and just ascended into the sky. Another example of, are we in a real world or not? And then also there is Jose, their brother Jose Acadio Segundo, who plays a major role in the strike by the workers at the banana factory. He's also the only survivor of the banana factory genocide, which happens when the company just mows down everyone who is striking. And he's very pensive, reflective character, and he ends up spending the rest of his time in the library or in the bedroom of the house studying these parchments that were left by the gypsies back in the first generation. Aureliana Segundo, from that previous generation, he married Fernando. We did that, right? And then they had Jose Acadio, Renata Remedios, Amaranta Ursula. Okay, so I'm going to go through those people. But that's who Aureliano and Fernanda had. Jose Acadio, he's sent to Rome to become a priest. Although he ends up ditching his studies, we learn later. Returns to Macondo when Fernanda dies. And then he ends up having conflict with some teenage boys in town. They end up killing him. Renata Remedios, the daughter, ends up sleeping with a mechanic who works in town. And when Fernanda discovers this, she kills the mechanic. Even though Renato ends up pregnant, Fernando doesn't realize it. Even though she sends Renato off to a nunnery, she doesn't realize her daughter had become pregnant. And then there's Amaranta Ursula, who ends up having a passionate affair with Aureliano, who was the son of Renato. I guess I'm getting this a little confused, but he was the son of Renato. And that Aureliano was brought back to Fernanda from the nunnery after Renato gave birth to him. And he ends up having a passionate affair with Amaranta Ursula. And they end up, at the end of the book, giving birth to the first child with a pig's tail. Are you all with me?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. As long as I know we're still alive. Okay. I'm almost done. At the end of the, I mean, I know a lot has been sped over, but I can't do everything. At the end of the book, Macondo is a very poor, dying town that many residents have abandoned. And we find ourselves left with Aureliano. See, what happened is that Amaranta, who was the daughter of Aureliano and Fernanda, and she ended up having this passionate affair with Aureliano, the son of Renato. So, like I say, that means that the aunt and the nephew ended up sleeping together, and they gave birth to a child with a pig's tail. Now, Amaranta died in childbirth, and baby with the pig's tail ended up getting eaten by a bunch of ants, or think, or something. I can't remember right now. It died. And then, like I say, what we're left with at the end of the book is Aureliano, reading the parchments who have existed, that have existed throughout this book and were studied by a number of different generations and people. And he's studying it and reading it while Hurricane rages outside, ripping apart the house that has housed these generations of families over the last 100 years. And this hurricane is ripping it apart, essentially destroying the house, destroying the story, destroying the book, ending the book. And the parchments that end up being decoded by Aureliano reveal everything that we just read in this book, and that the parchments had predicted everything that was going to happen with this family in these generations, in the history that occurred. And at the same time, by reflecting in itself, it's sort of like in a mirror, it did or it didn't happen. So anyway, that's sort of the end, but I just wanted to quote one thing, a quote that I found in the New Republic from 1977, and it says, "Reality, García Márquez, the author of this incredible book, said in an interview in Barcelona, reality, he said, is not restricted to the price of tomatoes. He asserts that life is filled with the miraculous lying dormant at the heart of the quotidian, adding that for him, the key to writing 100 Years of Solitude was the idea of saying incredible things with a completely unperturbed face. The ideal novel should perturb not only because of its political and social content, but also because of its power of penetrating reality, and better yet, because of its capacity to turn reality upside down so that we can see the other side of it. Hence, ghosts wander disconsolately throughout the household, the Buendía household. Priests levitate in proof of God, and hauntingly beautiful women like Remedios the Beauty ascends to heaven in body and soul while cleaning sheets out of doors, waving goodbye in the midst of the flapping sheets that rose up with her." Now, that was sort of just a little small thing, but that was at the heart of what he was doing. Now, also, as we all know, or probably know, this book reflects a lot of Latin America history and myth, and it's very fascinating on that level. As an aside, I just want to say that when this book came out in 1967, it had the same effect on Latin America in terms of impact upon the entire population that Beatlemania had on our country. A huge, huge, major effect on that country. And when he died in 2014, there was 3 days of mourning countrywide. So there are a lot of other things. And I know there's a lot of things I passed over, like the, you know, 4 years of rain and, you know, a lot of the train filled with 3,000 dead people. There's a lot of major things, but I'm passing it to you.
Kind of curious if everyone liked the book or had, like, what their first thoughts were.
All right, I'm just going to say I adored it. I think it's phenomenal. Anyway, next.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites, and it was a long time on the read list. So yeah, it's really a classic, you know, and I saw it with new eyes and this time around. And so I'm taking things in differently than I did before, you know, like what exactly is the magical realism. And hearing that little bit of your quote from the interview, Laura, was helpful to kind of place what he is going for.
Right.
But anyway, I'll leave it at that short little bit before we start pulling on threads.
Yeah, this is my second time reading it. And the first time I didn't really like it. I think I sped through it and didn't quite get it. But things started piecing together for me. So I appreciate it a lot more the second time around.
Yeah, this was my first reading of it. And at first, it was just very difficult keeping track of all the different strands of the plot and all the different characters with very similar names and so on. But I think that it grew on me as I went through it. I think I came to understand sort of what he was going for a little bit more as it progressed.
Yeah, I agree. I felt the same way. My family is, I am not Peruvian. My husband and his family are Peruvian. And, you know, being this girl from the South when I met him and meeting his family, like my husband is first generation American, it was interesting to listen to them talk, and they would talk about things, and they would sort of every once in a while sort of just put in these things about ghosts or put in these things about some sort of strange thing. And I'm kind of sitting there thinking, are we all tuned into the same channel? Did you just say that? They have this way of kind of saying really kind of crazy things that are part of their story. And so as I read this book, I thought, oh my gosh, that's totally what this is. You know, like these sort of you're reading, and at first you don't realize that it's magical, unless you've done some research. I didn't really know that it was magical realism. And it's written in such a way that you're like, oh, okay, well, like, clearly that's not what they mean exactly. That's sort of some sort of metaphorical thing, or I'm not understanding something about it. You know, like, there's a plausible way that you could explain it away. And then as it goes on, you realize, no, this is totally just fictional, you know, fantastical sort of imagery. It's completely made up and it's magical. It took me a while to really realize that, I think, while I was reading the story. And I think that's kind of the point, is that some of it is passed off. So what is his word? Everyday, commonplace.
Doing quotidian. It with a straight face.
Quotidian. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, in such a quotidian way that you're like, wait, is that, wait, what? What just happened? And you're kind of left with that feeling. But as far as the entire plot went, it took me a while to like understand, okay, this is a lot of repetition. And I honestly didn't understand the solitude until page 300, I started like, oh, okay, you know, three quarters of the way through the book, I'm understanding the effect of solitude on, you know, this family and what their ultimate end was. So I really enjoyed it, but I have to say it was tough to enjoy in the first part of it. I didn't really love it in the first part. It was just so depressing and sad and tragic that it was hard to really, I would say, enjoy. I mean, I definitely was moved by it, but enjoy would not be a word I would use until the end. And then I was like, okay, I see.
The names are a disaster. I feel bad for, I think, like, there's common critiques of people don't like Russian books because all the names sound so similar. Jose Arcado, Buendia, Arellano, like, every single one is the same, right? And on purpose,
that's
so
that's
hard
only
to
an control. American thing. That's only an American, because all of the names sound very unique to me. And I had no trouble keeping up with the names, but I think it probably is a result of the fact that it's, you know, they would probably say that about our American names, because they all sound very similar, but I think they were definitely different enough, but that they were related. I sort of thought of them in like as Jab and Cab, and, you know, like by their acronyms, their initials.
I feel like the fact that they all have repeating names, not exact repeats, but using Arcadio, Jose Arcadio and Aureliano over and over again, and also Ursula, etc. It makes me think that the point is something along the lines that the same character traits are repeating in different generations, and in fact that something that's observed in the novel, I think on page 181, Ursula observes that while the Aurelianos were withdrawn but with lucid minds, the Jose Arcadios were impulsive and enterprising, but they were marked with the tragic sign. And more generally, throughout the book, there is an idea that the family is marked by a certain fate, a sort of fatedness to suffer from solitude or have a predisposition to solitude or something like that. Over and over in this book, you have an observation about this or that character falling into solitude. And it would be interesting, I haven't seen this, but it would be interesting to see some sort of critical study that literally just takes all the mentions of solitude and try to sort of resolve them all, figure out what the hell he's getting at.
If solitude or solitary or some form of that word was like on every single, maybe not every single page, but it was like every other page. So it's very much a theme in terms of the generations. And I think the fact that they don't communicate well, they don't share, kind of keep things secret, and they withdraw from each other, and the problems that their solitude causes is, you know, for example, when the colonel goes out to war and he's this horrible person, and he, you know, he comes back and his mother doesn't even recognize him, and then something happened, he goes away again. But then he comes back at some point and they're ready to sort of welcome him with open arms. But he instead chooses to go sort of wall himself off in his shop in that room. And if he hadn't chosen to do that, and if so many of them hadn't chosen to go and sort of wall themselves off, like, how different would their generations have looked?
Since we're talking about it, I mean, I'll lay out. So my takeaway is that like 100 years of solitude is life, and that solitude is kind of a stand-in for the individual experience of a life. And when you have someone in these cases, they're like, Rebecca seems utterly alone. You know, she's in the house and of just like grief, you know, like a real, what's the Great Expectations bride figure anyway, you know, just, yeah, like living in, you know, a lost time and trying not to remember. These people do get very lonely, but it seems like everybody is, I mean, that's just my takeaway of the last line that, you know, you don't, you get 100 years, and what you do with that is what you do with it, and you don't get to reflect on it, and you can't predict it, and it's not something to be like ciphered out. I mean, that's not to be, I mean, that in a worse story, that would be a takeaway to like live life. But these guys live really full lives. So that doesn't seem to apply. This is just my observation, but I don't know what, you know, kind of water it might carry.
But Macondo was founded in a very solitary way. It was a town that was built, I guess it was only about 20 people, right? It run, you know, headed by Jose, but it was alone and isolated for a very long time. I think it's built in an area that was very far away from the rest of the country.
Yeah, I think that's kind of part of what the characters, the Jose Arcadios versus the Arcadianos, in throughout each generation. If you're a Jose Arcadio, you're sort of one of those people who wants to go out and to like find other things to build bridges, to move things forward, to kind of, there's a push towards progress within each of those characters. And the Aurelianos have definitely got a more solitary and more sort of like to keep things the way that they were mentality. And so you see the effects of both of those ways of being and their conflict. In fact, you see it the best, I think, in the twins, and then especially the way they died. I thought that was quite metaphorical and said a lot about the story in terms of there's a balance, right? Like they both had issues with the way that they were. One being kind of stuck in, I guess he sort of went insane after he, you know, witnessed that terrible tragedy, Jose Arcadio Segundo. And then, I don't know. I just thought those were two interesting characters. And then the way that they kind of died at the same time and this sort of different lives that they led, but they all sort of, they both kind of ended a little bit tragically. I guess everybody ended sort of tragically in the story.
Yeah, there's that, like, I feel like that's what I felt most when I was starting to get the grasp on the overall story. And there was this widescape view of each life, and it ended up seeming so depressing, as you mentioned it, Jennifer. Like, when you grasp each individual one, even though things were, lives were lived to the fullest, they all ended up so alone. I thought even, like, Ursula was supposed to be this matron that kept everyone together and was against the grain and tried to be involved in everyone's life, but even she had suffered from basic blindness from very early on, and in a sense was in a world of her own making, and also ended up, you know, I think a little decrepit and insane by the end.
Was it very early on though? Because that part, you know, from the beginning I tried to figure out, okay, what year are we in? And there's like some confusion with time with regard to some things that they said in the beginning of the story versus, I think she was like 80 when she went blind. So I don't think she was that. I think she was pretty old.
I think that's right. But so, there's a lot of confusion. I mean, there's a lot of jumping backwards and forwards in terms of just flashbacks and flash forwards.
Yeah.
So it's very, I mean, it's hard to tell at times.
He would tell something that happened at the end, like he would sum up a person's life and you would think you had heard that story. And then the next paragraph, he would begin the story of how it got to that point, which was in the last paragraph. So, you know, you knew the beginning, you knew the end before you heard the story kind of thing a lot. And I thought that was a little bit confusing at times.
Well, I think that was intended from,
of course, just it was definitely intended
in terms of the fluidity, you know, and time history bouncing around, playing on itself. I mean, I think that one of the ways to approach this book and find more enjoyment in it is to read it as so not realistic in any significant way. And that as a result, even though there is sort of a sort of very basic linearity that goes on as the book goes forward, obviously it jumps all over the place, time. And
that's what they said about the parchments, or, you know, I don't really have it highlighted or anything. I don't know where he said it, but where they describe them and they talk about how it's told in such a way so that you know everything thing that happens and you know who and how and when, but it seems as though it all happened at one instant kind of thing.
In one moment, yeah.
Yeah, in one moment. I don't remember that was, but that's how the book read. It was 100 years, and because you have Ursula, who was a really, pillar, who is from the beginning, it feels as though it's one lifetime, but it's so many lifetimes. And it was really very interesting to see how they bled into one another and then how everything became insignificant in the end because no one remembered. It was just like, oh, wow, that's crazy. That's so much what happens in life. Like, what do they say? That you're forgotten after, what, 2.5 generations or 2 generations or something?
Yeah.
Nothing will be remembered about you unless you're Einstein.
What does this... one thing I wonder about is, at the same time that this book is kind of suggesting that these characters are sort of fated, it's kind of evoking bits and pieces of Latin American history. And I was looking around in the secondary literature to see if anyone had kind of pieced together what the correspondences were. One decent summary that I found was the following. It was from Roberto Gonzalez Echevarria. I'm probably screwing up the pronunciation, but let me just read the quote. "There is lurking in the background of the story the overall pattern of Latin American history." And I'll be just skipping to the relevant parts. "We have a period of discovery and conquest when Jose Arcadio Buendia and the original family settle in Macondo. Then there's the appearance of Apolinar Moscoso, who is a representative from the Republic." The Republic isn't really even named in this book. This is, but I presume it's Colombia because they refer to it as the Caribbean, and we're talking about the northern coast of. But even just continuing the quote, the appearance of Apolinar Moscoso and his barefoot soldiers, i.e. from the Republic, is the beginning of the Republican era, which is immediately followed by the outbreak of the civil wars in which Colonel Aureliano Buendia distinguishes himself. Then this period is followed by the era of neocolonial domination by the United States, referring to the banana company coming over and taking over the town, which leads to this strange flood. It's strange. So the banana company leaves town and they say something along the lines of like, well, forget what it was exactly, but it will give some sort of benefits to people or something. But after the rains clear, and then it proceeds to rain for like 4 years magically, I guess. But in any event, going back to this summary, after the flood, there is a time of decay before the apocalyptic wind that raises the town at the end. And he suggests, this critic, Echevarria, the blend of mythic elements in Latin American history reveals a desire to found an American myth. Latin American history is set on the same level as mythic stories. Therefore, it too becomes a sort of myth. So what I'm wondering about here is, even though there's all this magic that goes on, how does this all connect to history, and what is this trying to say about history, and what is Marquez sort of suggesting that people are actually supposed to do, or what is he at least pointing out in Latin American history or human nature or whatever it is?
There definitely was like a real banana strike in his life when he was a young boy. And so that affected his family, and it was kind of, on a metaphorical level, it had the same...
You're talking about Marquez?
Yeah. So there was a banana strike in his town. And the commentary kind of on what happens, I mean, there's a threat of oppression, right? So there's the drive to move forward that Arcadio, the first generation, Jose Arcadio Buendia, wants to bring people in, and it ends up being that Ursula starts to bring people in, and then ultimately new people from all over come in. And when the railroad comes in, with the coming of the railroad come these people. But even before that, there was the outsiders who came in, the mascote, the magistrate. There's that first level of oppression where someone comes into this peaceful town and says, this is how you're going to do it. And they're able to sort of stave that off for a little while. But eventually, the outside forces become so strong that they are, this powerful family who founded Macondo is not even, you know, is mythical. It's not even really something anyone remembers. And then they make up stories about it. The history is rewritten and it never existed. And I think it's a sort of way of saying, you know, when you are a culture who has been subjected to sort of a colonialism and an outside coming in of other things that decimate your culture and they leave you in a state of oppression and the powerlessness you feel as a culture to overcome that. And what happens when people in great power write history in the way they do so that it suits them and such that everything that was real becomes this sort of mythical, magical silliness. We get that in the story. I think that's what it felt like to Marquez. I think he felt that sense of powerlessness as a result of what happened in his country and what happened to the culture that he grew up in. So I definitely see that that's sort of the big connection to him.
I feel it's important that, like, the maybe I missed other connections and metaphors, but I don't think the Banana Company episode, which was a clear, you know, representation of the U.S. hegemony, as you mentioned, was suffocating for the rest of the novel in the sense that it was incorporated in this string of living history. It was clearly, like, traumatic, and I think two of the brothers, one went insane and kept thinking about the 200 wagon loads of dead people that were just denied existence. And maybe I misread that, but I thought, like, his trauma was, like, passed on to the other brother after he died as well, whereas he repeated that as well on his death.
Yeah, because he said, remember that right before he died, and then...
Yeah, I feel it like wove together the story of like a nation, the story of a family, and in the sense to, I even got with incestuous relationship, just the story of civilization itself as it kind of begins. It could be read that way as well.
Right.
From the advent of technologies, the mixing of peoples, the fluidity of sexuality, and the how that becomes more rigid as time passes.
I think we should start from the beginning and talk about this because I have to say, the first part, in the very beginning, which felt like the very beginning, when Colonel Aureliano Buendia marries Remedios and she's like 9, it's difficult information to take in being from where we're from. But then I think the point would be that her parents are preparing her for this. So it's a different time and it's a different way of life and it's a different way of thinking. And there's just kind of a lot of that in this story and how it's just interesting to read it and feel sort of so disgusted by it. But really, the point is not to be disgusted by it, like these are bad people, because they're not. The point, because, you know, the Colonel was one of the more admirable characters at times in this novel. And it's just one of those things that's the way it was. That's the way people did things, you know?
Yeah. Well, maybe I just want to maybe like set this off in like a direction. We can go back to the beginning and get into some of these details, maybe with this frame. I mean, I think you were right, Cesar, you can also read this as kind of like the civilization of people, you know, but it really starts from, and I don't think we've mentioned this, they were in a plantation or like a wealthy town that both of their parents owned. And it was because they were first cousins. Yeah. That was the main issue. And then the murder that drove them out of town also. So what the frame I wanted to set up is that they're leaving an established society. So it's not quite Adam and Eve, and they have at least the foundations of Christianity, right? And they're going off and they're at the same time trying to go off and maybe find some kind of like primitivist society where they can, you know, be at home. And that's kind of Arcadio's, but then he switches. So that's kind of Arcadio's. He's going out, but then you see the baggage of society being brought in by Ursula, who like doesn't want to inbreed the pigtails, you know, like that's one of her, that's one of her fears. And that's like a taboo and that's a cultural thing. Right. And yet once they get there, you see Ursula becoming like the definer of the home and let's say little city conservative. And you see Jose Arcadio Buendia go nuts on technology and wanting to expand his lot in life and be more than an animal. And I think that tension right there is what's played out, because even the gypsies very early on are threatening to Ursula's conservative sense, but are enlivening to Jose Arcadio's, let's say, liberal sense of like, you know, exploration of ideas and thoughts and the way things can be.
And the universe. Yeah.
And, you know, and isn't getting it wrong either, right? Like, I mean, he does seem right. cool at some points, but then figures out the Earth is round on his own, you know, after giving some formulations.
Right.
And, like, gets the gold back. Anyway, all of these are just details. But it seems to me there's a conflict of time, which is broad, but I mean that they're at once trying to defy, they're not trying to, like, live in time. They go out of it, and then it's like someone was saying, like, encroaching on them. It just keeps coming in waves and wears it down.
I think that's so interesting when you think about that concept and the mansion. If you just look at the mansion over time and you think about how many times it was, you know, it was first it was built and then it was added onto and then it was in disrepair and then it was made new again and then it was in disrepair and then it was made new again. And it was just like this cycle of, you just had this image of this house that had been patched together and worn and reworn over the years. Kind of reminds me of that time marching on needed to be knocked down.
Well, I just wanted to add that, like, there's a way that she thinks about time that I think the Malkiades thinks about time, and that's what the parchment was at the end, that it's not going forward, it's going in a circle, and rather than...
It's reflecting on itself.
Well, Ursula specifically says a circle.
Wait, I'm missing you all. Say it again.
I was just saying Ursula specifically says she believes it's going in a circle. Malkiades might put it that it's all compressed at all one time, so that you're seeing the birth and death of someone in the same day if they were born
right.
raised in the same room. And I just, you know, this was old lit class, but we read a novel and an idea came up in it that was how the Native Americans thought about, and First Peoples is better, I think. Anyway, my phrasing here.
Uh-huh.
That they have a way of thinking generationally, six generations forward and six generations back in this fictional instance, you know, of this tribe. And I thought that generational, before you make every decision, you would think six generations forwards and backwards. And that was a new way of dealing with time. And it had a way of encountering your generational history. And I just feel like that just might be a lens to see how little I know about being able to approach this, you know, from like their mythology and like cultural history. It's a bit like Murakami. Like, I'm not sure what real life Colonel Sanders means, but, you know, I take it as, you know, significant. So I'm not sure what he's doing with all of these things, but I just wanted to kind of put out maybe a bag of tricks.
You mean in terms of time?
In terms of how to think about time and how he might be thinking about time and how maybe there's cultural differences of thinking about time.
I'm going to read one quote that you brought up. It's on page 335 of my version. It says, "What did you expect?" he murmured. "Time passes. That's how it goes," Ursula said, "but not so much." When she said it, she realized that she was giving the same reply that Colonel Aureliano Buendia had given in his death cell. And once again, she shuddered with the evidence that time was not passing, as she had just admitted, but that it was turning in a circle. Is that the part where you were referring?
Exactly. And I just pull on that thread and then Malkiades' thread with his parchments and then extra, you know, text was thinking about how different cultures reflect on time and how that might be relevant to how we think about what's going on here, because we, you know, tend to progress through the story from the beginning in its genealogical order, even though it does jump around a little bit, you know, narratively. We get chronological state, you know, we're not jumping ahead 2 years and coming back. But, you know, then at the end, you know, we kind of get the impression that that might have not been the way to be perceiving these things, and that there were hints all along that things were timeless. So anyway, I just want to maybe underline that.
Well, I mean, I think that's why they have those images of that. You have the images of the ice and the image of the glass mirrors. That's sort of a way of moving your subconscious to not think about time in a linear way, because we naturally are going to read, when you read something, you read it in a linear way. And actually, the way the plot is laid out, or plots, there is sort of an undercurrent of linearity, because that's what happens when you have generation after generation of generation. It follows a linear line, but it isn't. And I think that's why he also, I mean, he introduces a lot of elements to sort of mess with our perception and sense of time here. But some of them have to do, I think, with those images of ice and glass and mirrors and circles.
It was like at the end, I was like, okay, so basically this is a case for just not figuring out either figuring out all your stuff or not figuring out your stuff. Because it was kind of like all of these patterns are repeated generation after generation. And part of the reason they're repeated, which is, I think, such as in real life, is because no one really ever heals. No one ever really comes to terms with the issues that they face. They kind of go off in their solitude and they don't work them out in relationship, right? They don't.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what he was saying.
So then at the end, you have this situation where it's like there's this parchment that tells everything. So you kind of, I thought about it like, okay, if I go to a therapy session and I found out all the whys and the wherefores about why I make the choices that I make and the decisions that I make, it's not going to make a damn bit of difference. You know, the difference it would be in the doing of something different. And so, and there's at one point, there's a quote in the book where he says something like, you know, all of that basically doesn't matter how much knowledge you have. If it doesn't help you invent a better recipe for chickpeas, what good is it? So the point is, they spent all their time trying to decipher this stuff and trying to figure it out, but they never really like lived. They never went out into life and had relationships with people. They lived in their solitude. So I don't think that they did live that well. I think if you don't go out and have relationships with people and work through the issues that you have, or if you don't try to kind of become open about things, because so much could have been avoided if the last dude had known who he was. Like, so many of them didn't know who they really were. And things happened as a result of them not knowing their true identities. In a way, it's understanding that you do need to know who you are. You do need to understand your demons. You do need to like analyze yourself a little bit. But at the same time, you have to go out and you have to be in relationship with people. And that's how you work through your struggles. But not by, no man is an island, right? You can't do it alone. You can't just sit in a room and figure out life. It's got to be figured out in relationship to other people. And they really met their sticky end a lot of times because they just didn't do that. They didn't commune with one another in a meaningful way.
I was just going to say a counterpoint to this might be the second generation of Buendias, because Colonel Aureliano Buendia, though he sequesters himself later on, I mean, it's hard to find when. Okay, so anyway, two examples. Let's look at his life. He was the introverted guy who wasn't going out, and then he turned that around and became a general and fathered 17 kids at least, and And so by that measure, he was out there and has lived more than most modern Americans. You know what I mean? In that way. But then you have someone like Jose Arcadio, who was presumably just really fucking happy and got shot in the ear and died without any kind of solitudinous remorse. And that just seems like but I think that the stories are a little bit interesting. So I don't think that like straight up solitude with a kind, I mean, I take what you're saying is like a good point, but, and I'm not trying, and I don't have a specific reading, but I think that taking solitude, like 100 years of solitude as to be a definition of the individual life makes more sense for Jose Arcadio, because it's not like it was a nameless tragedy. I mean, my reading of it this time was that all that land he was stealing from people, they finally just assassinated him.
Yeah.
And he was stealing money and stuff like that and didn't give a fuck because he didn't have to, because he was the big guy on campus. But then he got shot in the head. And,
right.
You know, that's, and so those are just differences with the notion of solitude as a affliction versus as a condition.
Well, I've also seen in secondary literature here and there that they describe this family as very egotistical. Like the solitude that exists is a form of egotism.
Well, I don't know how it would not be. I mean, I guess if you were some kind of like ascetic hermit, that might fit that definition.
Aren't we all allowed to be alone if we want?
Yeah, I just don't. I feel like it's kind of like a. I'm just not taking that charge exactly right, because I don't know what a counter example of that would be. Like, I'm not sure what it's saying other than to maybe add ego where it doesn't really. I mean, Jose, Colonel Aureliano thought that his pride was getting in his way, so that point might land well there. He thought that
right.
If he could just get that beside him, he could be more victorious in battles and realize that he was waiting on people to change their minds, and that was a mistake.
Well, I think what's interesting about that character is just, I don't know, I mean, maybe if we could just discuss that for a little bit. You know, Colonel Aureliano, let's call him Aureliano because that's what he first was, and calling him two different names is apt, because when you learn about his character later, I just found it to be like staggering who he became, right? You never saw that coming. Kind of like, by the way, you never saw that coming when Amaranta says, no, I don't want to marry you. And then the dude kills himself. Like, that was one of those wow moments in the book, but we should get to that one as well. But he was this gentle soul, right? He was in contrast to his gigantic brother, and he was kind of softer and more feminine, and like, definitely he was not as masculine as his brother. And then, like, he didn't sleep with anyone for a very long time. And so he goes and he sleeps with Pilar, right? Yeah. And he de-virginizes a lot of Buendias, it seems. And then still we see him as like a meek character, and he marries this girl that's so young, you know? And if we get over the fact that it's really pedophilia and we just sort of say, okay, she was a young girl, which I think we're supposed to. I mean, am I supposed to be as offended by that as I was? But I don't think I was.
I think that your response is actually kind of valid here. I mean, I think Aureliano has this problem of his way of going out into the world and trying to work with and commune and love other people kind of just has this way of reinforcing his own solitude. I was really struck by this when during the Civil War, when Aureliano was a colonel and he was leading the liberal rebellion against the conservatives, he eventually renounced really all of his liberal ideals just for the sake of trying to make the liberal party appeal more to the populace and thereby improve the base of support among the people. And around that time,
I just want to put a fine point on that, was that he realized that what they were asked by all those acquiescences was that they were just talking about pure power. And that, yeah. I think that's just a stronger form of his decision making. He kind of lost all faith at that point.
Yeah. Well, Marquez, the way that it's put in the story is that he was lost in the solitude of his immense power. And when he's talking with officials from the party as to what they're actually going to be fighting for, what Aureliano says is that means that all we're fighting for is power. And he ends up agreeing to this document with the officials from the Liberal Party that, yeah, that's what we're going to give up our ideals and just make it so that we're fighting for power.
And there's a good quote that kind of goes back to the beginning with him with regard to that, where we kind of, from the beginning, he was never for anything. He said, if I have to be for, I don't know where it is, because I have an actual book here. It says that I'm going to butcher it, but he says, if I have to be for anything, I'm going to be for the liberals because those conservatives are tricky, because he sees his father-in-law, Magistrate Mascote, messing with the vote, the liberal versus conservative votes. And he's kind of, I think, like, this is despicable. So I'm just going to join the other side. And it's just by chance that he joins this. I mean, I think he does have some liberal tendencies, because he says, oh, I feel sorry for, he says one or two things that maybe make you think he's really liberal. But at the end of it, you kind of realize that he seems to be fighting for something that is opposed to the despicable actions of his, you know, of what he sees the tricky people of the conservatives. You know what I mean?
What sets him off is, isn't that a woman that's beaten to death or beaten up?
Yeah, it's the soldiers of Mascote, isn't it?
Like, he's just against the fact they're horrible, right? They beat this woman, and he's not for anything. He's just against that. And then he actually ends up becoming that in some weird way, but yeah.
What's the connection between, you know, Jennifer mentioned earlier on, you know, this problem in Latin American history of powerlessness in the face of outside forces, and what is the connection between that and solitude? And I feel like there's a sense in this book in which the solitude is maybe a way to solve or somehow remedy the powerlessness they feel in the face of not only political forces, but also natural forces, just their own isolation. There's a quote later on in the book. When Amaranta is the child of Jose Arcadio Buendía and Ursula, the first generation, she's weaving a shroud, and her own death shroud, really. And she has an observation. So there's a lot of characters in this book that enter into some sort of weird, repetitious activity. It's a little bit like obsessive compulsive disorder.
The doing to be undoing thing.
Yeah, and this is the quote. It was then that she's doing this weaving of her own death shroud. And the quote is, it was then that she, i.e. Amaranta, understood the vicious circle of Colonel Aurelio Buendia's little goldfishes, the little goldfishes being Aureliano's own version of this repetitious activity. He makes a bunch of little tiny goldfishes over
right,
and over
again. Right.
So continuing with the quote, and this is the crucial part, the world was reduced to the surface of her skin and her inner self was safe from all bitterness.
Yeah, that deserves a pause. So it's kind of like saying that these things that they do are a protection, like mindless kind of busy work, maybe to prevent themselves from going too inward.
Well, that happened
over their life.
I think the idea is that they use it to, in order to turn inward, that, you know, reality is such that the best thing that you can do is sort of turn inward in this way. In this sense, I think they're not, it's not just some sort of weird genetic predisposition towards solitude. I think they're external circumstances that are pushing them in that direction as well.
Yeah, I was just going to actually, yes, I want to second that and say that I think that another point was, you know, this isn't like allegory exactly, but I think that if we read this as like mythology, then we can get a lot more out of these characters, what happened to them, and, you know, the storied way that they go down, because it's less like they have a conventional set of circumstances. And then we're seeing these characters, you know, bump up against that. It's really that they're very interesting characters in very unconventional, you know, conventional circumstances, which, you know, really, like, Amaranta is very tragic because let me just run through her love thing right here. I mean, she gets attracted to Pietro as well, and her sister does too, and they fall in love and feels rebuked. And whenever Rebecca rebukes Pietro and he decides that can go and get her now, she feels that and wants to make him yearn for her like she felt he didn't yearn for her with Rebecca. And so it's very psychologically understandable. And then he kills himself, again, psychologically understandable. Like, all of these characters, I feel like, have a very logical, consequential interaction with one another. You know, so Jose Arcadio rips people off and is living high on the hog and gets killed because of it. You know, when Pietro kills himself, it's because he thinks that she'll never love. And she was like, oh, I was just messing with you. You know what I mean? Like, I just needed you to, like, really prove it or whatever.
That just sent chills on my spine when I read that. Such a calm demeanor. Oh, I would never marry you.
And thought that she was just gassing him. You know what I mean? Like, you could tell that she just wanted him to keep crooning. But then that same thing, like, turned her bitter. And she couldn't accept anybody again and even rebuke people who would have taken her, like, time and time again. And it was just this hardening. And, like, Rebecca chooses to be with Jose Arcadio in this, like, passionate affair that's just wonderful. And she doesn't even need her family. But then he gets shot in the head and then she's left for, you know, 70 years. So
in that house.
In that house that grows around her. I mean, it's like biblical.
It is actually very biblical, and I think that that's definitely a good word for it, because there's a lot of pestilence, and there are these sort of signs with the yellow butterflies, and the yellow comes up here and there, and this sort of tragic feeling to the whole book.
I agree with the kind of stand-ins and the consequentialism you described, Nathan, but in the same sense, I feel like these aren't rational characters that you would take from other books. I mean that in the sense of, well, maybe I've just been reading too much economics, but like rationality is having certain goals and then acting in order to achieve them. You wouldn't think that Rebecca acted wisely by sitting in a room for 50 years, or that, you know, after going crazy, the patriarch was chained to a chestnut tree and that was fine.
Yeah.
Or reading the manuscripts for years on end, or even, Aureliano Buendia, after he came back from the war, he also just fell into solitude. It doesn't strike one as...
Yeah, but that's a rational argument, though.
Yeah, and you can't apply
love and, you know, like...
Yeah, you can't apply that to this.
Losing life. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, what do you know if you've seen, like... I'm not saying you, but, like, you know, have seen someone's head blown off in front of you that you love and, you know, expected to make love to them in, like, 10 minutes. You know what I mean? Like, that's hard to square.
Jose Arcadio Buendia... He does not do rational things. I mean, he is definitely, he's the beginning of sort of like crazy behavior. You know, he's really out there with the stuff that he does.
What?
Like, I just felt like when I was reading his first character, I'm like, I know this guy. He's the guy who always has a harebrained scheme, who never really gets anywhere. He's so smart. He's got a lot of really good information. I'm sure he's filled with promise and possibility.
Who are we talking about?
The very first, the patriarch, Jose Arcadio Buendia.
Oh, okay.
You know, and Ursula constantly, and the women in these stories are the rational ones, are the sort of more down to earth, like, I'm going to smack you around and, you know, get you in line, because the women have definite issues. I'm not saying that they don't.
Yeah, there's some women, I'm telling you.
No, but I'm telling you, these men do some really nutso things that would never, you know, they're not what everyday people do.
This isn't an everyday situation.
Yeah, it's not an everyday world.
Like, adventure off so that he can be with someone who society would reject is a very rational proposition, right? Like, he wants to be with someone he can't be with. And so the only way to do that is to use his party and haleness to go off and make another society.
I'm talking about more about the times he goes and, you know, spends weeks on end giving up his life trying to figure out how to turn gold, you know, things into gold. I'm talking about those kinds of harebrained schemes that he has. He has these bouts of lucidity and sort of really great ideas where he sets up the town and he becomes this great hero. But then there are these times where he does things that are just ridiculous. And you're like, how is he not a laughingstock that he's doing these things?
Yeah, but those things seem connected. So I don't know that you can get rid of his, you know, discovery of a global Earth. And also, you know, I just don't know that those two things can come, you know, like, undone from each other. And it seems like, you know, one would lead you into other things where you might, you know, invest everything and, you know, go mad for a time. And that seems like those two things would ride along with each other.
The fact that we're having this conversation, I think, is part of the tension, right, in the story, because you kind of get these hints while he's doing these things. Like, there's part of you, there's probably part of everybody that reads it, that's like, oh my God, why is he doing this? This is nuts. But then you think all he needs is to actually accomplish one thing from his crazy harebrained scheme that will, and all of this silliness will have been justified by some discovery or something. And that's kind of how things get discovered. Like, there's a way that they talk about the vapors in the lab, such that you, when they introduce the daguerreotypes, is that how you say that?
Yes.
You guys noticed the way that they kind of introduced that. It was the same kinds of things that he had already had in his lab. And it just gave me the feeling that, like, this is the guy who experiments and does all these crazy things. And then something really, if nothing amazing is invented, then he looks like a nut. But if something amazing is invented, then suddenly he looks like a hero. And that's the only difference between people that are like him, is that all you need is one sort of invention to be, you know, justified in your crazy harebrained schemes.
Didn't he invent a solar weapon that he tried to sell? I didn't mean the rational thing as a pejorative way. I meant it as, I think, a poor framework with which to analyze these characters. Like, even just think about, like, the last book we read, and we could think about the framework of this prototype having plans and succeeding eventually in living out his kind of evil life. I feel the totality of these characters are super messy and complex, and they don't break down to just even, you know, the patriarch was a mad dabbler. Like, at one point he dabbled in alchemy, at one point he gave it up, at one point he took up inventions, and a huge part of his life he's sitting by a chestnut tree, and it all this, it fills into this messy life that has a more realistic tinge to it, despite the magical aspect.
It's like a telenovela.
Yeah.
I think that, but I kind of wonder if the characters do have a certain sort of rationality if you take the goal that they're interested in as being sort of individualization, I guess you could say. I mean, a lot of the stuff that seems crazy, I don't know, it's like they're trying to assert themselves in the world and to try to, you know, differentiate themselves from society and nature and kind of make their mark on the world. And then that eventually fails, which drives them into other sorts of avenues for trying to assert their own selfhood. It's neurotic in the end, but you know, it's at least, it sort of makes sense what they're trying to do through their actions.
I'm wondering if you mentioned the selfhood and the personality and these recurring types, which are shown through names and through clear like personality traits that these characters have. I wonder how much his opinion on actual freedom and freedom of choice is, because there seems to be the strong tinge of determinism. And I mean, this is what depressed me and made me sad, because it seems that people are chained to their fates in such a way that there is not very many happy ever after stories, in the sense that it's, you know, a good book and not cheesy, but
yeah, I think it's a fatalistic book.
The one other thing I wanted to mention is the saddest line to me was when Ursula at one point, I can't find it, was realizing that the Colonel Orleano was incapable of love, you know, despite having these 17 children, despite going after the 9-year-old, that's what she realized in the end, that it was all a play of stubbornness or something like that. Whereas she thought that Amaranta was too capable of, which is why she couldn't give herself to any one person.
I had a hard time with that section because I was thinking, is that sort of a truth that we're supposed to take? Or is that more commentary on Ursula and the way that she sees her kids? Because I just felt like I couldn't believe that the Colonel Aureliano, whatever, you know, that guy, he just, the way she described him made him so unlikable to me and so sort of sad and terrible that, and one-dimensional, that I just was like, well, that's more a commentary on Ursula and her point of view and what she maybe needed to herself.
He did that, best friend to being shot.
But he didn't go through with it.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, he goes, you know, and but then the guy is like, you know, honestly, if this is what you're trying to do, then like just shoot me, and they like make up or whatever. But he lays him out even more. That's an interesting moment. Maybe we can put a pin in that. But he basically lays out Aureliano, saying that, you know, he doesn't realize that he's gone too far and that he's, you know, become a monster.
He's become what he's fighting against. And I think when he comes back, there's that sort of metaphorical circle that he says, nobody can come within 10 feet of me, not even, you know, my mother. And I think when you look at that and you say, okay, what does that mean? What, like, on just a metaphorical level, he's walled off his heart, right? He's gone out. In my opinion, this guy started out with such a noble and just reason for fighting the war. And I thought, if I just take that character in isolation and what happened to him, he was a tender-hearted guy. He was disgusted by something that happened and disgusted by a lack of justice. And he goes out and he uses war and he fights for justice. But the point being that when you engage in war, you become what you detest, right? War is not the answer. Like, war is just going to make you worse. And so he, in his way, he had to put that circle around him and not kind of feel, because that's what you have to do when you engage in war. So I guess it just felt like, yeah, this guy is definitely got issues, but I don't think that he is so, that's just such a simple way of describing him that I felt like, no, he's way more complex than that. Because after he comes back, he does change, and his mother's point of view about him changes even. So he becomes aware of what he's become. And I think that the way that he's changed as a result of the war and what he became weighs on him. Once he becomes aware of that, I think that's why he has to go into solitude. And I think it's a protective mechanism that every character uses as a way of coping, you know, with this really horrible things that happen in life.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of causal thing that I'm talking about. You know, I think that's right. It makes sense. It adds up. You know, it's actually a tragic story. The more tenderhearted and the more hollowed out he is, you know, like, it's sadder, but it's just, it epitomizes it. And so I'm kind of caught up. I'd like to be able to, can we go back to the idea of irrational thing, or maybe like what their other motives might be, or like what doesn't make sense, I guess, because like I see this kind of like, you know, ping pong things that they set themselves in motion, and that's what makes it kind of tragic, is because it's tied to them and how they are.
Remedios doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I just think in isolation, I don't get the point of her character in the story. I mean, I know I kind of get it, but I'm not 100% sure that I'm really getting it.
It turned Aureliano, I think.
No, not her. Remedios the Beauty. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. That's our happy ending right there. She got out.
That's actually, blew out.
Is that what it is? Is that she kind of is the only...
Right, she's the genius. That's what was interesting. Seeing Colonel Kurt's eyes through war and then saw her and, you know, knew that she was beyond him. and, you know, could see the fabric or whatever.
Can I actually link that up with something? Because at the end, you know, Aureliano, the son of May and the mechanic.
Mechanic, yeah.
So that Aureliano has a friend in town who is a bookstore owner who is this old Catalan. And eventually the Catalan leaves and the Catalan writes back to Aureliano with advice. And the advice is follows. The old Catalan bookstore owner, he ended up recommending to all of them that they leave Macondo, that they forget everything he, i.e. the Catalan, had taught them about the world and the human heart, that they shit on Horace, you know, one of the writers that the Catalan had them read, and that when, wherever they might be, they always remember that the past was a lie, that memory has no return, that every spring gone by could never be recovered, and that the wildest and most tenacious love was an ephemeral truth in the end. What's the solution to this tragic fate then? That's like, and what characters honestly get closer to getting out of it, right? Like, I think the book is, it's obviously a bad, whatever is going on with these characters, it's a bad pattern or process. It leads to tragedy. There has to be some way out of here, right?
Also, it's a bad world. Like, it's not individual characters, like, you know, creating their circumstances. I mean, you know, banana companies and, you know, like other, you know, like the gypsies even, you know, and then the Muscote coming in, you know, all the things that we've detailed. I mean, it's this kind of constant attack. And so, you know, is it just tragic? Is it cautionary?
I think it's interesting that Aureliano, the one that didn't die, the last name was Babylonian. And the story of Babylonia in the Bible is such that, I'm sure you all know, but I'll just say it, is such that the people of Babylonia, right, they felt like they could, depends on your interpretation, right, but the people of Babylonia thought they could build a tower and they could sort of be like the gods. And the punishment was that they all had different languages. And the punishment, like, I've read different versions. So I'm like, there's the mythological version that I read in Greek mythology, that version, and then there's the Bible version. So the idea is that if they think that they can work together because they can all communicate and they can build a tower to the sky, that God kind of puts them against each other by having them all speak different languages and they can no longer communicate. And so I thought that was an interesting name, and I don't think it was on accident. I mean, maybe it's a common name in Latin America. I'm not sure.
I think the names are significant.
Right? Didn't that seem like really significant? And the point being that, you know, when people don't communicate, when people don't talk to one another, and, you know, confusion happens, it leads to confusion and it leads to problems. And they should have been more communicative about what was going on and more open and less solitary and less in solitude. And some of these tragedies would have happened. I don't know. Nobody seems convinced.
It's easier to see, like, the only thing I can think of is like how to rewrite the story so that things are happier, you know, like if, I'm not trying to.
Oh, okay. Okay.
No,
okay.
Like, that's the only counterfact that could make them doing things differently make sense. Like, I don't see that they could have done. And so this is like, again, like just a tragedy or a cautionary tale. I mean, if Amaranta, you know, had run to Pietro and said, fine, I'll be second, you know.
That was the thing that I was like, what the hell are they putting this off for? Why do they have to wait 1,000 years?
And then it was like another, like, war.
A new church or something.
Yeah. And that was a part of the new development, is that they had to bring their god along with their magistrate.
But yeah, I agree with your take, Nathan. I feel like a big part of this is, you know, they're not living isolated and the outside world is acting on them. And you see this life as it is lived and not through this narrow frame of a character having a plan and developing it. Like, even the example of, what's the Italian's name? Crespi? Is that right?
Yeah.
Pietro?
Yeah.
So, like, because Amaranta threatens to kill her sister, or half-sister Rebecca, if she married Crespi, right?
There were so many great lines like that. you know, it, no matter how far they send me away from you, I'll make sure that
I'll kill you
for this marriage. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And then Rebecca, you know, out of nowhere, because Jose Arcadio came back, ends up with him. Like, it just, all of a sudden, but it made sense.
Yeah, that flat out attraction. And then she completely, you know, rejected Pietro. And, you know, maybe she, yeah. And even, you know, and there's also, I think it's worth, I mean, now that we're in the late hour, it's worth mentioning that that Marquez, you know, obviously has a very rich imagination, but the story kind of goes beyond its borders with other short stories, specifically Innocent Iradiera and The Melancholy Whore. It's a girl who is brought in very early on that Jose Arcadio leaves to pursue. Remember her tragic story, where it was that she accidentally burned down the house as a child, and her evil stepmother forced her into prostitution to pay for it back, and the life they were leading. And so she was in constant, you know, servitude. But that story is continued, and I can't recap it in a short story. And so that might be true, moreover, in other places.
Are you saying that story about the girl that he found for 20 seconds?
In a short story?
That's an entire short story.
Wow.
That's a terrible story. Oh.
Well, I think that she gets, I mean, tragic and sad and terrible, but there's more to it. They bring up the man. Anyway, I just wanted to just underline that Marquez is maybe got more of a universe than just in the story. And so, you know, it's worth further reading to go into other things. Like A Very Old Man with Enormous Wings is paralleled in that thing that they find and hang up. You know, that devil that was walking around the streets and hooves and stuff like that. This isn't a singular entity, this story, is what I'd like to just maybe suggest.
And I think along those same lines, to try to sum up like the purpose or the meaning or the whatever of the story, I think it would be kind of silly, because it is full of so much meaning, and it's life itself, you know, and it's everything that we experience and everything that we know to be true in this sort of concentrated form of this generations of people in this one family. So of course it's exaggerated, because it's all of everything that can be experienced in life is happened upon this family. And it's everything that it's experienced since the dawn of civilization, you know, happened over the course of this 100 years. And it's just a representative of that. So you're going to have, I feel like it's just, it's so hard to talk about, because you're going to have every single theme that could ever be in a book is in this book. It feels huge. Yeah. And so, you know, when you talk about the telescope and the magnifying glass, and he says, pretty soon you'll be able to see in everyone's home, and or something like that in the very beginning. And it's a commentary on change and progress and the effects of outside forces and what happens when a family is affected. And, you know, you start with your little nuclear family, and then, you know, people go out into the world, and then the family dynamic changes. And it's a commentary on that. If you live in a family right now, or if you've had a family of your own where you've got this little small nuclear family, and it's such a culture, and then somebody gets married and everything changes, and kind of, you could write an entire, you know, dissertation on just that. And it's all of that is in here. It's almost impossible to talk about.
I think that the character that I think comes closest to having a halfway decent strategy for dealing with, you know, solitude and this situation that they're all in, I feel like is me, the child of Fernanda and Aureliano Segundo.
Is that the one whose lover gets shot in the back? I'm just trying to.
Yeah, that's right.
Ends up a mute and a nun in a convent for the rest of her life.
And a nun, not a
Well, it was great until that whole thing happened. So just to explain her background, just to remind everyone of her background, basically she was raised by Fernanda, who is a very sort of strict aristocratic woman. She has all these aristocratic pretensions. And Fernanda, you know, sent her off to learn the clavichord. She became a clavichord, which is like a piano, I guess, like became a clavichord virtuoso. And there's a comment on 270 saying, Mame bore up under the exhibitions with the same stoicism that she had dedicated to her apprenticeship. It was the price of her freedom. She seems more of an truly sort of independent character until literally she's physically forced to the convent. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's almost like a sense of she understands the advice that the old Catalonian was giving to just, you just need to like leave. Like you need to, I don't know. I mean,
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, you got to get out of here. You got to do something different.
Like, even if you're physically there, like, you have to kind of just pretend and almost be, you know, in terms of dealing with the shit that people throw at you, like, you have to kind of separate yourself from it in some way. Although now that when I'm describing it, even though I found her to be the most rational, I guess you could say, character in a way, or at least the one with the best idea of kind of what to do. I mean, obviously, her approach doesn't work either. I mean,
maybe it's the beauty.
Yeah. Can I just read out one quote? There's from a writer named Octavio Paz. Apparently, he wrote a book in 1950 called The Labyrinth of Solitude, which, you know, suggests there was some sort of pre-existing kind of philosophical thought about solitude and its relationship to sort of philosophy and Latin American life. And the quote, I haven't read the essay. I discovered it through reading this book and kind of looking over the secondary literature. The quote, I think, is interesting. And what he says is, solitude is the profoundest fact of the human condition. Man is the only being who knows he is alone, and the only one who seeks out another. His nature, if that word can be used in reference to man who has invented himself by saying no to nature, consists of his longing to realize himself in another. Man is nostalgic and in search for communion. Therefore, when he is aware of himself, he is aware of his lack of another, that is, of his solitude. So there's a sense, I mean, maybe there's just like some existential tragic fatedness that this book is kind of getting after. I mean, at least that's the idea. I mean, just from that one quote, that sounds like what Paz's own idea is, that solitude is almost like a lacuna in the eye and that there's just no way of kind of getting around it. And it's just a matter of sort of negotiating and figuring out what the trade-offs are supposed to be in dealing with it.
And that it's like a central thing in Latin America. Is that what he was saying?
Yeah. I mean, he connects this idea, supposedly. I'm literally reading off of Wikipedia. I'm not trying to have any pretensions of being well-read here. But he connects it with a lot of different things, like particularly Mexican society. And it seems to be very influenced by existentialism. He was a big deal poet and writer, like Samuel Beckett translated Paz. And it just struck me that, wow, there has to be some sort of connection or, you know, in some way, there's a sense that maybe I would have to actually read the Paz's essays to know this, but there's a sense that Marquez is kind of picking up the idea and blowing it up to epic proportions in some way. Yeah. I would wonder if that is actually the case.
So maybe we can go to last lines, and my line would complement that read. But I don't know if you guys have any other thoughts. I don't want to just jump in.
I mean, I think that, you know, we probably could have a billion thoughts because this book is so huge. But I did have one question or one thought to bring in. Or you remember the banana company incident where all of the strikers or the majority, if not all of the people in the company were murdered by, I mean, all of the workers were murdered by the company? Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And then Jose Segundo, I think, and he ended up on the train and he saw all these dead bodies from the massacre being taken away. And then, I guess a little while later, when he was back in town, back in Macondo, and I guess investigating or asking, or it was like it didn't happen. People didn't believe it happened, the massacre. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I mean, question?
Yeah, I was just thinking about, I mean, it was kind of shocking to me. And what I said, what is Marquez saying by putting out this idea that this horrific, horrible massacre occurs? And then we go through this whole process of Segundo being on the train and seeing these dead bodies on the train. And then we get back to town and people are like, what are you talking about?
It's like the official version of history is magical realism. I think that's his idea there.
I agree.
Paragraph to you. I think this will help you because it says, in this most brutal political episode in Gabo's novel about life in Latin America, the author makes a bold statement with unbelievable grace and style. As a young boy, Gabriel Garcia Marquez saw his town, his family, and his life blown to the four winds by the real banana strike. As a man, he comments on it with powerful melancholy and truth, showing clearly how events can be manipulated, revised, and excised by those in power. Even the Buendia family, who held every ounce of power at the beginning of the novel, find themselves helpless in the face of powerful entities from outside their culture.
I've read that too. I read something like that too as well. And also, I think I also read that company that happened in Marquez's family town that collapsed or something turned into Chiquita, the company Chiquita. Mm-hmm. I heard. But anyway, yes, I did see something like that.
Some of the funniest, you know, some of the funniest morbid writing was when they caught like the owner,
the owner.
And then like they got lawyers to prove that it wasn't the lawyer. They proved that he was actually dead. And then eventually they proved that the company didn't exist and there were actually no workers.
I know. It's just so.
Oh, I
but that's literal. That's literal. Well, that's literally what the law is, that you don't have to treat employees as employees because they're, you know, temporary laborers. That's like a major thing in the law.
But going back to that idea of people in power, of these white people in power, and the rich can make things disappear. It's like Trump saying, what are you talking about? Korea didn't put off no missile. I can see how Marquez is pointing that out, you know, like, people in power can make things go away.
In a way, we didn't talk about this, and we probably don't have time, but in a way, these are white people, though. Like, these are the white people of
Mr. Brown.
Yeah, because there's also the natives, right?
Right.
Who are opposed to the inhabitants of Macondo. Or not opposed, but just, like, separate from.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah, they divert the river.
Isn't there a comment early on that, I forget which one it was, but I could have sworn that Ursula had native. That she had, that she was partially descended from the natives. Am I wrong?
Maybe that was true for Ursula.
I mean, it kind of, I think there was the idea being there was some sort of combination of, you know, in Latin America, much more than in the big, it strikes me that the big difference between United States, how the United States ended up and how Latin America ended up, or at least one of the big differences, is that in the United States, there really wasn't a combination of peoples. I mean, maybe there is to some extent now, but, you know, at least back in the day, you know, basically the Indians were just wiped out. My understanding, at least, is that there was more mixing in Latin America in terms of the native people and Spanish kind of entering into families. I'm not sure willingly, I'm not sure, you know, without coercion, but, and I don't know. I mean, there's a sense that they're their own, it's their, like, I don't know. Sorry, Jennifer, go on. I don't know what I'm reaching.
Well, I don't
know.
You're just making me think of like when I go to Peru, with my husband's family, right? They all speak Spanish, but then we go to like Machu Picchu, we go to Cusco and, right, there's the native people that are there, and the reason they speak Spanish is because Francisco Pizarro came over from Spain and he took over, and it's like a lot of South America is the result of people coming in and conquering, right, and taking over. And I don't know, this story is very difficult for me to know where it's supposed to be, because there's a lot of references to Mexico and he's from Colombia, so I think it's just the whole of Latin America. I mean, did anybody have any clear concrete ideas about the location?
I wouldn't have a better idea, but Colombia is the birthplace of Marquez, I believe. So.
And they right. mentioned the Caribbean a couple times,
yeah,
suggesting exactly. It's on the coast, and the northern coast, at least, of South America.
Yeah,
I thought it was all over the place, because I just know the banana. I thought the banana incident was referencing the United Fruit
company
like, coup in Guatemala, basically.
Yeah, so the people who are Spanish speaking in these countries are the descendants of people who have come in and taken over, right? Because the actual native language in a lot of these countries isn't Spanish. So it's kind of interesting, right? That they're the result of a lot of oppression.
Yeah, and they don't have a really strong connection to Europe whatsoever. I mean, that's what was really striking to me, that when Pietro Crespi came in, it was like he was this foreigner. There's Fernanda. A sense, yeah, right. Or Fernanda coming in and also being sort of like this, she has these pretensions to sort of European nobility or whatever, but it's just absurd. It's so kind of disconnected from whatever the hell Europe was. It was, it's a sense of a bunch of people who were kind of like left alone, and just on this sort of island and just sort of left to fend for themselves. They end up developing their own life.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I throw in a last line? Because I'm going to have to go soon.
Go for it.
All right. This one is about, I think, referencing one of the Orleano and Jose Arcadios, I think the second pair. Page 280 of my 355. In the small, isolated room where the arid air never penetrated, nor the dust, nor the heat, both had the atavistic vision of an old man, his back to the window, wearing a hat, a brim like the wings of a crow, who spoke about the world many years before they had been born. Both described at the same time how it was always March there, and always Monday, and then they understood that Jose Arcadio Buendia was not as crazy as the family said, but that he was the only one who had enough lucidity to sense the truth of the fact that time also stumbled and had accidents, and could therefore splinter and leave an eternalized fragment in a room.
Mm, that's good.
That was a good one.
Well, I might jump in before anyone steals it. And this is what I wanted to tie in with yours, Dan, because, again, like, I'm not super married to this, but after what you read in this last line, my big connection, again, is that 100 years of solitude is a human lifetime. The last line is, then he skipped again to anticipate the predictions and ascertain the date and circumstances of his death. Before reaching the final line, however, he had already understood that he would never leave that room, for it was foreseen that the city of mirrors or mirages would be wiped out by the wind and exiled from the memory of men at the precise moment when Aureliano Bibliano finished deciphering the parchments, and that everything written on them was unrepeatable, since time immemorial and forevermore, because races condemned to 100 years of solitude did not have a second opportunity on Earth.
Like humans.
Yes.
And like you took my line.
Yeah. Oh, I had to jump in and get it. It's just the best. It's titular.
I know.
Titular. Sorry, Laura.
That's okay.
There's a theme of stealing Laura's lines. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's happens all the time. That's all right. I'm good with it.
Others?
So I have a last line. This is early in the book on page 65 when Aureliano is falling in love with Remedios. And it just struck me that his love just leads him into greater solitude. And the line is, he looked for her in her sister's shop, i.e. Remedios' sister's shop, behind the window shades in her house, in her father's office. But he found her only in the image that saturated his private and terrible solitude.
Beautiful.
Which page was that on?
65. Someone needs to read the first sentence too.
The first sentence of the book?
The first sentence, yeah.
That's so weird. I don't understand you people. First of all, Nate takes my line. And then Daniel, you're like thinking the way I'm thinking. I was thinking the first line, the first line. What is this?
Is someone else not going to read it? Here, I'll read it. Okay, you read it.
I'll read it. Chapter 1. Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. It's important. It's very important. It says everything. And also, since you all took my line and everything else, I'm going to read this paragraph from the New York Times discussion of this book in 1970. It might have been just another phase in the incestuous life of Macondo, like the 32 revolutions or the insomnia plague. Remember the insomnia plague? We didn't even discuss that. I mean, that was like, what? Anyway, or the insomnia plague. But enchantment and solitude cannot survive the gringos any more than they can avoid the 20th century. Like so many else in this strange and moving narrative, the end seems to have been inevitable. And yet the North American reader, in thinking of this narrative filled with haunting creatures and events, can hardly help being particularly haunted by the spectacle of his countrymen, the perspiring guests who did not even know who their hosts were, trooping in to occupy the best places at the table, period. Marquez has shown us with this extraordinary art who some of the hosts were, or what is more important, who they thought they were. He has also written a novel so filled with humor, rich detail, and startling distortion that it brings to mind the best of Faulkner and Günter Grass. It is a South American genesis, an earthy piece of enchantment, more, as the narrator says of Macondo, an intricate stew of truth and mirages.
I wanted to bring up the metaphysics of this world. How Christian involved is it? I mean, it doesn't like specifically talk about heaven, but anytime there's magic, I'm wondering what the source is or like what. I don't think it's relevant. It doesn't do technology work or, you know, magic powers for people, but
Like, the flying carpet the first example of, like...
No, there was the other guy that, you know, turned invisible with the liquid, you know? It was, like, in time with that. Yeah, the magic carpet, you know, blood, you know, stream.
Frogs in the water for 4 years, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and so I just wonder how much Christianity has a role. And it's explicitly there, right? They're carrying this Spanish conquest god with them. So it's just interesting to me because I'm wondering, you know, where some of the creativity is coming from. But
can I suggest something? So think about very long ago when people first came to be people and, you know, they're pretty smart and they're stuck in this world where, you know, they can figure out causes and they're curious about things. And that naturally leads people to wonder, you know, what the hell is going on with the world. And I just got to a sense that people just sort of began telling stories about what the world was and what was going on in the world and where it came from and all this kind of stuff. Almost as this will to sort of come up with something or other. I don't know. I get the sense that basic will to figure out what the causes of things are and understand the world and that it's somehow linked to this practice of magical realism in the sense that, you know, Marquez is himself kind of thrown into this world of Latin America with its history. And he's thrown into his own family and, you know, as we all are. And in telling this story, it's as if he's trying to kind of self-consciously tell the myth of his own people and his own family and his own, you know, world. And just the fact that putting in the magical realism aspects of it is just kind of highlighting sort of what I think he's doing, or there's a sense in which, I mean, he talked about his grandmother telling him stories, you know, with the straight face of fantastic things. And you got to imagine that's like what the first stories must have been like about the gods, right? When people were striving to come up with any sort of causes for anything. And there's a sense that that's sort of what's, at least my sense is, that's what's going on with the magical realism aspects of the book, is that he's trying to come up with any sort of story about how the world is in Latin America and you know, so in any event, that's my own take. It's just a guess, but
I felt the same way. I felt like the way that he portrayed things was like from that of a child, where, you know, what your experience is that as a child is that, you know, you don't really understand a lot of why things happen the way that they do, but you have to put together sort of a narrative to explain it. And the need for that, just, you know, sometimes things just get explained away in this sort of magical way and nobody really understands it, but it's just what we do. I mean, I think I don't think it's necessarily all that different from what we all do. We all kind of have these stories that we tell ourselves. And there's a point in the book at which they talk about the last two of the generation, Veranta Ursula and then Aureliano Babylonia, when they don't know his origins and they just kind of have to say, well, we're going to not really think about it too much because if we know the truth, then it'll be problematic and it's easier not to know. I think that's the way a lot of it was approached. And I thought, yeah, that's like what we do in life. You know, we just kind of tell our version of the truth of things to cope.
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly understand the cultural forces behind creating religion, you know, and I think my concern is just where it's not, I mean, this isn't an actual world, you know, so this is from the conceived mind, and that person is bringing to bear certain kinds of understandings, and if they have a framework that they're playing within, I kind of want to know what that framework is, you know, if things are... You know, and so some of these, like some of this magicism or whatever, it doesn't really change how you would do anything in the world. So it itself is the unexplained phenomena. So I don't think that it's actually standing in to explain another phenomena. You know, I mean, it's just Remedios the Beauty floating up. You know, it's not like she was carried away by a wind and there was a story about her floating up. So the origination of the like primary fact is what's interesting to me, that there is this magic. I mean, I read it much more as phenomenological, and I think it makes sense that way to communicate these events are usually like something to somebody. So, you know, the way that it makes an impression, and then that would lend to that cultural argument, I think, more, because then we can imagine that these characters in this cultural position through narration are experiencing it as such. But these are a lot of distinctions, and this is another conversation for like an hour.
Yeah. I will give you my last line. I cut out for a while there.
Yes, we're waiting on you.
Oh, that was very nice of you. I'm sorry. I lost connection, so I have no idea what you guys were talking about, but I will just share that mine is completely arbitrary. Just was meaningful to me, not necessarily to anyone else, but it said there was, it's several lines. This is the part where Aureliano Segundo is living or staying for a long time with Petracotes. And he says, intrigued by that enigma, he dug so deeply into her sentiments that in search of interest, he found love, because by trying to make her love him, he ended up falling in love with her. Petracotes, for her part, loved him more and more as she felt his love increasing. And that was how, in the ripeness of autumn, she began to believe once more in the youthful superstition that poverty was the servitude of love. And it's not really those lines, because just those lines on their own don't necessarily, you know, they're not so impactful, but it's what happened in their relationship in context of the story that I thought was just a really nice, I liked that. I thought that was a bright spot in the really sad book, quite honestly.
Yeah, it was quite remarkable, that relationship, the way it evolved. But I did want to say one thing. In case you don't know, but maybe y'all do, that Netflix is coming out with this.
Yeah, saw that.
Next year.
Just wonder, how the hell could that possibly work?
I want it to work. But I mean,
his relative, Marquez's relatives are involved.
Oh, so that's one thing I wanted to bring up. You know, his son is, goodness, I forget it, but you can find it. He is behind the HBO show In Treatment. It came and went years ago, but I think it's wonderful. And there is.
Are you talking about the In Treatment where the guy's a therapist?
Yes.
Really? And his son is behind
that? Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah. Also find his son, because he's also like a producer of The Sopranos, and
oh my god,
has, so follow his son's name and you're gonna find good stuff.
Wow, fascinating.
He's also like Garcia Marquez, like, but I forget his first name. Rodrigo Garcia Marquez.
Wow, see the names.
Yeah,
I mean, that's like so common. Everybody in my family's name, by the way, is Carlos, just so you know.
But I am fascinated to see how they're going to do this.
I'm so excited for it. If he's got any hand on it, then I trust it will be good. I
mean, oh, good.
So visual that, like, I mean, I just want to, you could just film that blood from Jose Arcadio, like that scene itself.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
From the line out to, yeah. Oh, that's
so nice. That'd be so cool.
And can we just talk a little bit about some of the imagery? I know we got to go, but I just have to say that, like, the time when there was the rainfall for 4 years and they pulled leeches off of Ursula's back and everything was covered in moss and like, that's when you really felt like this is a mythological sort of story. And then when the dryness came and Ursula gets her second wind, were you just not like, oh my gosh, when you read that? Can you believe Aramanta did that to the poor Crespi guy or whatever?
God, I hope they do this. They're not going to, I mean, are they going to cut anything out?
I can't imagine that he would do anything that would just, you know what I mean? Like, I have a lot of, once you said that, because they did a movie of Love in the Time of Cholera, and it was terrible.
Yeah.
And they took, because they took it for realism. You know what I mean?
That's the problem.
Yeah, you lose the I hate saying magic.
Yeah, but I don't know how they're going to do that. Because, I mean, like, how could you do the insomnia plague, or like you say, the 4 years of the rain? I mean, and what happens to the streets in Macondo after 4 years of rain? I mean, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to do that.
It's got to be like very much exaggerated. It has to be definitely sort of like obviously not realism, where they have to go deep into the magical portion of it. Because otherwise, I think you would miss the whole point of this.
Do you know, there's a director, I think it's Iñárritu. I might be mixing these guys up. The one did the movie Beautiful with Javier Bardem. And there is a huge magical realist inspiration from that. The lead speaks with bereaved people. And in the film, you see what he sees, and he sees ghosts. It's not like about that. It's just that's his phenomenal deal.
His experience.
And that director, I think he, it's not Alfonso Cuarón, but it's Iñárritu. He came out with, look up the director Iñárritu, and you'll find good movies that are like this. I would recommend Beautiful.
Right. If you want to
see something that's like this, then that's Beautiful. Spelled B-I.
God, no, I hope they use Javier Bardem for this. Wouldn't that be great?
I wish they used him for everything.
Yeah, for everything. I agree totally.
So, but one thing I want to, you know, the easy part of this is going to be the CGI. The hard part is going to be the tone. Because it's easy to have, like, humongous CGI monsters and blah-de-blah, and oh, isn't this so cool? But, like, you have to make the CGI so it isn't cool. So it's just, like, reality. So it's like his grandmother just stating a fact. That's going to be the hard part.
Yeah, that's what made me think of The American Gods, is because if you've ever watched that show, you're watching and it feels very sort of realistic and normal, and then all of a sudden these bizarre things happen. Yeah, you have to be jarred by it, right? You have to be like, are we all tuned into the same channel? It reminds me from Dusk Till Dawn, where you're kind of watching it, and all of a sudden, did you watch that?
It's a two-part movie. I really enjoyed it. Whenever I saw it, I was like, oh, this is a great movie, like really down to earth. You know, and then it just goes off the rails.